Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Emilio San Pedro, and at 14 hours GMT on Thursday, the 20th of February, these are our main stories. Chancellor Merkel has condemned racism in German society after 9 people were killed in a gun attack by a right-wing extremist. South Korea has become the latest focus of global concern about the new coronavirus. And
I'm a New Yorker. I know how to take on an arrogant con man like Donald Trump that comes from New York.
U.S. billionaire and Democratic presidential hopeful Michael Bloomberg has presented his anti-Trump credentials, but he's faced fierce criticism from his rivals. Also in this podcast, Swiss prosecutors have brought corruption charges against the former Secretary General of FIFA and the president of the football club Paris Saint-Germain. And
you're looking at a pioneering experiment in the mass violation of human rights whose contours we don't even properly know yet.
One of India's best-known authors has spoken out about conditions in Kashmir. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel has spoken out strongly against racism in Germany after a suspected far-right extremist killed 9 people in the quiet West German town of Hanau. The Chancellor pledged to stand up against those who seek to divide Germany.
Rassismus ist ein Gift. Der Hass ist ein Gift. Und dieses Gift.
Racism is a poison. Hate is a poison. And this poison exists in our society and is already being responsible for many crimes. The government stands for the rights and values of every person in our country. We don't define citizenship by origin.
Federal prosecutors are treating the case as terrorism. Most of those killed were believed to have immigrant backgrounds. Shortly before we recorded this podcast, I asked our Europe regional editor, Risto Piuka, what we know about the gunman and those he killed.
The shooter is a German man in his 40s. He was not known to the police, but he left, if you like, a legacy online. Lots of writings, lots of videos, conspiracy theories, racist comments, racist essays, theorising about so-called population replacement, attacking women for his failures in the romantic field. He had his weapon legally, though. He was a marksman. We don't know how he became radicalised, but probably online, because a lot of the material he left behind has echoes all over the world. Right-wing extremists from New Zealand to America often refer to these particular theories.
And we heard Chancellor Merkel there speaking in strong terms against racism. But effectively, what more can she do to curb these far-right views?
That is a very big question. Of course, the obvious answer, and that has already been called for, is more surveillance of the far-right activists. There needs to be, one would assume, a change of emphasis, almost of mentality, because one thing that is not quite often understood is that far-right violence is far more common in Germany than, for example, Islamist violence. Over the past 30 years, 4 times as many people have fallen victim to far-right violence than to Islamic violence. So lots more resources need to be targeted at them, but we are looking at a big field. Police estimate that there are about 10,000 violent far-right extremists in Germany.
Risto Piuka, our Europe regional editor. An unprecedented crisis. That's how the South Korean authorities have been describing a new outbreak of the coronavirus in the country. Its 4th largest city, Daegu, has become the latest focus of concern linked to the virus. Its mayor has told all its 2.5 million residents to stay indoors following a sharp rise in confirmed cases. So far, one person has died in South Korea, the country's first death attributed to COVID-19. These people in the capital, Seoul, express concern.
I'm very worried since someone died, which is something I'd feared. I'm wearing a face mask today because I thought I should be more careful while using public transport.
I hope response measures are carried out quickly. In the past, our government was late in responding to some situations, but I hope they show a more reliable side this time.
Dozens of these new cases in South Korea have been connected to a woman who attended a religious service in Daegu. From Seoul, Hyung Kim from BBC Korea told me more.
the Korean media are calling that patient number 31. And the patient attended a religious service twice. And from what we know, one service involves more than 1,000 people. So we know that at least 23 cases were from that religious group. That group is called Shincheonji Church of Jesus. And also it's from one specific region, Daegu. It's Korea's fourth largest city.
And what measures are the authorities taking? How prepared are they to deal with this crisis?
Up until now, many of the cases showed fairly good recovery rate. We saw 16 patients being discharged from the hospital declare that they're cured. But the problem is that many of the cases are occurring from this specific city, and many are worried if this city is medically equipped enough to handle soaring number of cases. They are closing down schools, and they are closing down hotels and other areas that the patients are known to have visited.
And what's the wider reaction been across the country?
So many people are definitely alarmed. But the good thing is the Central Diseases Unit in Korea has been holding presser every day, twice a day, and journalists get to grill them about the information. So I think that's what differentiates Korea from China. But there are some online hashtags of potential bias and hatred and hostility toward this specific religious group. I'm seeing so many hashtag on Twitter. Even some media reports are criticizing the way they do their worship and hold their service, how it could easily bring up the number of infections. So what worry people is that this could lead to hostility toward a certain group of people in Korea.
Hyun Kim of BBC Korea. Elsewhere, Iran has become the first country in the Middle East to report deaths from COVID-19. In Ukraine, protesters have blocked roads to try to prevent people who've been evacuated from China from being quarantined close to their homes. And in China itself, daily routine is still on hold while the authorities battle the impact of the outbreak. Compulsory quarantine and closed businesses are now the norm, and life is anything but normal for many of the country's 1.4 billion people. Our China correspondent Stephen McDonnell put on his face mask and took to Beijing's all but empty streets to see how people were coping.
In the Chinese capital, residents spend a lot of time outside. Their houses are often quite small, and so people love to go and gather in the parks or with their friends in restaurants to have a meal. That's not an option right now. Basically, if you're not at work, you're at home.
A man walking by himself in an otherwise empty street says his job is in a city office tower. Ask how many of his colleagues are going in at the moment. He says that those whose hometowns are outside Beijing haven't yet returned to the city after the extended Lunar New Year break. The authorities here are trying to minimise people coming into contact with one another in an attempt to slow the spread of the coronavirus. So at the moment, apart from going to work, is he venturing outside much? No, he laughs. No other activities. Down the road, a guard at the entrance to a housing estate is checking IDs. In Beijing, the government has ordered that only residents are allowed into apartment blocks. I say to the guard that he must be tired. No worries, he responds. How's he feeling at the moment? Actually, quite nervous, he says, adding, the situation with this illness is severe, so we're a little scared.
Beijing's underground train system normally has to deal with millions of commuters. No problem getting a seat today, though, I think.
Recorded announcements echo around the city's train stations, with hardly a passenger to soak up the sound. Some of the messages are routine. Others are warning people to take care with their personal hygiene during the crisis. Arriving in another district, there are people around, but only in dribs and drabs. One woman tells me she's currently working from home. Are other colleagues doing the same? Yes, but her company... is gradually easing more staff back into their office. A cleaner walks back to work with a plastic bag in each hand, carrying a few things to make some dinner. Is he worried that he could have been infected when he packed up those items in the shop? I'm not afraid, he says. I wash my hands frequently and thoroughly. A retired woman tells me that people need to stay positive. She advises not believing in rumours and not panicking. With a good attitude, we'll defeat this illness for sure, she says.
That report from Beijing was by Stephen McDonald. Two U.S. congressmen visiting India have expressed concern over the situation in occupied Kashmir. They've called on the Indian government to release political detainees and restore normality in what was a semi-autonomous territory. The Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, repealed Kashmir's partial autonomy soon after he was re-elected last summer, and the territory was put into lockdown, accompanied by a near blackout in communications. The comments by these U.S. politicians come days ahead of a heavily hyped official visit to India by President Trump. Arundhati Roy is a Booker Prize-winning author and one of India's most outspoken political commentators. She recently visited Kashmir, and Paul Henley asked her for her impressions of the situation there.
The main thing now in Kashmir is that how do you report on the silence? You know, how do you report on a population that is just completely under the boot of a very, very dense, perhaps the most dense military occupation in the world? A population that is more or less cut off from the internet for months. There was no phone. So what you're seeing is a place that is slowly falling off the map because, I mean, you can't even get an OTP number, you know, to use your credit card. So businesses are failing. Young people are being unable to apply for courses. Researchers can't do their work. Doctors can't do their work. So you're looking at a pioneering experiment in the mass violation of human rights whose contours we don't even properly know yet.
Do the majority of people see themselves as under occupation, as you put it?
I would say so. If you travel to Kashmir over the years, I would say so, yes. The other thing one has to mention is that you have the entire political class in prison. Three former chief ministers are in prison. So there isn't any mediation between the troops on the ground and the local population. There isn't any government.
Are independence-minded Kashmir voices being heard in India? There are many Kashmiris inside India. Are they being stifled?
See, Kashmiris are in great danger wherever they are. And if they are in India, more so because they are, you know, alone. Recently, I think a young boy was beaten to death in Rajasthan. So actually, you have a very strange situation because India too has erupted now because of the new citizenship laws. And while the streets of Kashmir are silent under this kind of boot heel or the jackboot in some ways, you have the Kashmiri chant of Azadi echoing on the streets of India. And what lies between the silence of one street and the sound in another is a very intriguing question.
What are the difficulties for you being an anti-government voice in India at the moment?
You know, oddly, right now you do have an efflorescence of anti-government voices. Recently in Delhi, the Modi government was wiped out in the elections. Although I wouldn't say that this election was fought openly challenging the Hindu nationalism. It wasn't. It was sort of municipal facilities versus allowing the government to function at the center in its Hindu nationalist way. But still, there has been an efflorescence of voices. And so perhaps, you know, I feel a little less lonely than I did earlier. But still, the dangers are very present and very clear because we are constantly being just humiliated or defamed on the mainstream media. You have the constant call for, you know, cases to be filed. If I speak anywhere, you have, you know, this massive police presence and you know that the police is on the side of the people who wish you harm. So a lot of people, and not just me, but in particular the Muslim community, is under attack from all the organs of the state. And here I will include mainly the mainstream media, which is not an organ of the state, but acts worse than an organ of the state.
The Indian novelist and Booker Prize-winning author Arundhati Roy speaking to Paul Henley. Still to come in this edition of our podcast.
It would work out as being a huge dam of about 160 kilometers from France to the southern of England. And then all the way in the north in Scotland, there will be another one going all the way to Bergen in Norway.
We speak to a scientist who's calling for two immense dams to be built across the North Sea and find out why he thinks they're necessary. Switzerland has filed corruption charges against two of the most powerful figures in world football, a former FIFA secretary general and the president of one of Europe's richest clubs. The case revolves around the awarding of lucrative broadcasting contracts for the World Cup and other top tournaments. Our sports news correspondent Alex Kapstick told me more about the two men and the charges they're facing.
Well, firstly, it's Nasser Al-Khelaifi. He is a Qatari businessman. He's also president of Paris Saint-Germain, the French club bought by Qatar. They've lavished enormous amounts of money on that club to make it a top team in European competition. He's also the chairman of Be In Media. That's a major player in acquiring sports rights for big international sporting events, which are shown on television. And he's also a member of UEFA's, that's European Football's governing body there, ruling executive committee. He is accused of inciting Jerome Valcke, this is a man who was the former secretary general of FIFA, to commit what's described as aggravated criminal mismanagement. A further charge of bribery against Mr. Al-Khelaifi, that was dropped after FIFA withdrew a complaint against him because they said they'd reached what was described as an amicable agreement. Now, Jerome Valcke, he's a disgrace. Former Secretary General of FIFA. He was banned for life in 2016 for corrupt activities. He's accused of exploiting his position at FIFA when awarding television contracts for World Cups, Confederation Cups, all FIFA-owned events. And the charges include bribery. And they relate to his period in office between 2013 and 2015, and specifically when awarding the media rights for Italy and Greece.
And how much money are we talking about?
Well, World Cup rights are worth millions and millions of dollars. But in the case of the bribery allegations, it's claimed that he accepted payments of €1.25 million from an unnamed businessman who is also charged with bribery. The investigation also involved a luxury villa in Sardinia that was owned by Nasser Al-Khelaifi. Valcke, it's claimed, was allowed to stay there rent-free, and that was worth, what Swiss prosecutors say, in between €900,000 to €1.8 million. Euros. They can't pursue this as bribery because FIFA's dropped the complaint. And now they say, but because Valcke didn't declare that, that's led to this charge of criminal mismanagement, and Nasser Al-Khelaifi is effectively accused of helping him to do that.
Alex Kapstick, and since I did that interview with Alex, Nasser Al-Khelaifi has issued a statement saying that he's been cleared of all suspicions of bribery definitively and conclusively, and that even though a technical charge remains, he fully expects to be cleared of any wrongdoing. In the U.S., candidates vying for the Democratic presidential nomination have rounded on the former mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg, in his first televised debate. Until now, Mr. Bloomberg, a self-made billionaire who is funding his own campaign, had stayed away from the early part of the contest, focusing instead on national advertising. Up against the other contenders, he was forced to defend his record on policing, race relations, and sexism in the workplace. Our correspondent Sophie Long reports from Las Vegas.
Enter the new contender.
There's a new person on the stage tonight, Mayor Michael Bloomberg.
The pre-debate exchanges promised an explosive evening, and that is what was delivered. Collectively, the other candidates on stage had a lot of ammunition, and they wasted no time in using it.
I'd like to talk about who we're running against. A billionaire who calls women fat broads and horse-faced lesbians. And no, I'm not talking about Donald Trump. I'm talking about Mayor Bloomberg.
His response to all those opening accusations.
I'm a New Yorker. I know how to take on an arrogant con man like Donald Trump that comes from New York. I'm a mayor. I was a mayor. I know how to run a complicated city, the biggest, most diverse city in this country. I'm a manager. I knew what to do after 9/11 and brought the city back stronger than ever. And I'm a philanthropist who didn't inherit his money, but made his money. And I'm spending that money to get rid of Donald Trump, the worst president we have ever had.
He wasn't just questioned about the stop and frisk policy that disproportionately targeted African Americans when he was mayor of New York, but the language he used to defend it.
2015. This is how you describe your policing policy as mayor. Quote, we put all the cops in the minority neighborhoods. And you explain that as, quote, because that's where all the crime is.
Strong language then, less strong now.
I've sat, I've apologized, I've asked for forgiveness.
Defending his record on sexism, he stumbled.
I am very proud of the fact that about 2 weeks ago, we were awarded, we were voted the most, the best place to work, second best place in America. If that doesn't say something about our employees and how happy they are, I don't know what does.
Senator Warren, you've been critical of Mayor Bloomberg on this issue.
Yes, I have. And I hope you heard what his defense was. I've been nice to some women. That just doesn't cut it.
Questions on sexism led to questions on transparency.
Mr. Mayor, are you willing to release all of those women from those non-disclosure agreements so we can hear their side of the story?
He said there were only a few of them. Joe Biden joined the calls for them to be lifted.
It's easy. All the mayor has to do is say, you are released from the non-disclosure agreement. Period.
Mike Bloomberg was given a pretty rough ride, but his name is not on the ballot here in Nevada for the caucus on Saturday. The first time Americans will have the opportunity to give their verdict on his performance is on Super Tuesday in just under 2 weeks' time.
Sophie Long with that report. Staying with the U.S., President Trump has appointed a new acting director of national intelligence. He's Richard Grenell, who was the U.S. ambassador to Germany and is considered a Trump loyalist. But Democrats are angry and have pointed out that he doesn't have any background in military intelligence. Jeremy Shapiro is the research director of the European Council on Foreign Relations here in London. He's formerly a member of U.S. State Department staff. Paul Henley asked him for more details about why some people think Mr. Grenell was unsuited to this job.
Well, I'm pretty sure it's because he has absolutely no experience in the field. And generally speaking, the person who's held this position has had a lot of experience in the intelligence community and in intelligence activity. And it does seem as if Ambassador Grenell's main qualification for this job, which might be really a very important one, is that he is close to the president. The president seems to have confidence in him and seems to have trust that he will follow the president's diktats in these matters.
So he is a staunch loyalist. Does past experience show that to the president?
Absolutely. I think you would struggle in the looking at Richard Grenell's tenure in Germany or in anything in the last 3 years to find even a sort of sliver of distance between him and President Trump. He has been very, very loyal. He has been vociferous in pushing Trump's positions in Germany and everywhere else.
He's also been compared to President Trump in terms of his personality by some of the German media. They've been saying that he's abrasive, that he's narcissistic, that he's thin-skinned.
Yeah, I can't exactly comment on that, but I would say that he is very forthright, that he, like President Trump, doesn't spare feelings and says very much what he wants to say. And so he has definitely rubbed a lot of German officials the wrong way. He's taken a different approach than most U.S. ambassadors to Germany. He's been less interested in making sure that the U.S. and Germany have really good relations and more focused on pushing the president's priorities in Germany. And that has definitely rubbed a lot of German officials the
wrong
way.
Which seems to have included suggesting that Germany should have a new chancellor. He's been fairly anti-Angela Merkel, hasn't he?
Yeah, I would say not directly, but he has said many times that Germany would benefit from moving to the right. And that has been taken as being anti-Merkel and been taken as pushing the agenda of some of the more populist parties within Germany, which is also not appreciated by the mainstream German parties.
I should ask, for those who don't know, what the job of Director of National Intelligence exactly involves, briefly.
Yeah, it's a complicated job. He oversees the 17 U.S. Intelligence agencies, which are spread throughout the government. And so it's his job to coordinate those agencies to make sure that they're not working at cross purposes and to make sure that they are reporting up the chain to the president and to the White House in a coherent fashion.
And briefly, he is the first, or he will be the first, openly gay member of cabinet. Is that significant?
I don't think that it's significant, really. There's not much indication that that has much to do with his appointment. I don't think it's been a disability for him in the Trump administration, but it also hasn't been a plus. And, you know, he's been active in gay causes and very openly gay for a long time, but it doesn't seem to have affected his relationship with the president or with the administration.
Jeremy Shapiro of the European Council on Foreign Relations speaking to Paul Henley. Two scientists have suggested building dams to enclose the North Sea to defend Northern Europe from rising sea levels. This project would be called the Northern European Enclosure Dam, or NEED. The technical challenges would be immense, and so would the cost. So how is this even possible? And realistically, what would it achieve? Alan Kasuja put those questions to one of the scientists behind this proposal, Sjoerd Groskamp from the Royal Netherlands Institute for sea research.
It would work out as being a huge dam of about 160 kilometers from France to the southern of England. And then all the way in the north in Scotland, there would be another one going all the way to Bergen in Norway. And that total would be about 637 kilometers. It's a huge length and it crosses depths of about 100 meters on average. There's just one location that's about 320 meters deep, which could technically be a bit challenging. But as far as I've known so far, what we say in the paper, but also what I've heard around me, this should be possible.
And it's important to stress at this point that it's an idea, not necessarily an actual infrastructure project.
What we envision it is mostly as a warning. But the problem is, if sea level gets that high, then this could be a real solution. But right. It's a solution that nobody wants.
The one thing that everybody's talking about with this idea is the fact that it could cost up to $540 billion.
Yes, but that's not that much.
Do you have it lying around somewhere?
Well, no, but if you, it's only 0.1% of the GDP of those 15 countries combined that will be protected against sea level rise. And that's when you would spread this number out over 20 years. So that's not a whole lot of money, and especially not when you compare it to all these countries that would have to protect themselves individually.
What are the other likely problems, do you think?
Well, one big one is the shipping industry. So there's some very big harbors, Rotterdam, Antwerp, Bremerhaven, and a bunch of others that are within the enclosure, and the ships won't be able to reach them. So that is one thing. But those harbors would have to continuously adapt or move anyway if sea level really rises. So the money spent on that, for example, and the technical challenges associated with that are not going to be any bigger than if we would have to build a new harbor, for example. Another one is river outflow. So the North Sea will become a freshwater basin where now it's salty ocean water. Because there's still water from the rivers flowing into this basin, and that has to be pumped out. Otherwise, there will still be sea level rise within the basin, and we don't want that. Mm. And the last thing is that the ecosystem will completely change. Salt water becomes fresh water. So, of course, lots of animals will die, and you will get a new ecosystem. And those are all things that we don't want. But if it gets this far, if we're that far into climate change and sea level rise, then these kind of solutions are the only ones left, and we have to deal with these kind of problems.
Sjoerd Groskamp of the Royal Netherlands Institute for Sea Research speaking to Alan Kasuja. Finally, and still on the subject of the oceans, scientists say there has been a resurgence in the numbers of blue whales in the South Atlantic. Here's our science correspondent, Jonathan Amos.
When the whaling industry set up business in South Georgia in the early 1900s, it's estimated there might have been nearly 250,000 of these majestic animals in the Southern Ocean. But within just a few decades, butchery on an industrial scale had reduced their numbers to a few hundred. The last assessment of Antarctic blue whale numbers was done in 1997 and estimated the abundance at just over 2,000. The next assessment will come out in a couple of years and may indicate that there are now up to 10,000.
Jonathan Amos. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. And if you want to comment on this edition or any of the topics we've covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Emilio San Pedro. Until next time, goodbye.
Every year, the BBC World Service invites you to vote for the coveted BBC Women's Footballer of the Year, celebrating the skill of individual players, their commitment to the women's game, and its growing popularity around the world. Voting is now open for the 2020 prize. Just go to bbc.com/womensfootball and pick your winner. You can choose from England's Lucy Bronze, the USA's Julie Ertz, Australia's Sam Kerr, the Netherlands' Viviana Miedema and the USA's Megan Rapinoe. Voting closes on the 2nd of March 2020 at 9 GMT and you can vote for your favourite by going to bbc.com/womensfootball where you will also find our terms and privacy notice. That's the BBC Women's Footballer of the Year at bbc.com/womensfootball.
I have a secret. I wore the wrong foundation for years. Then I discovered Il Makiage, the boldest new brand in beauty. With 20,000 five-star reviews and 50 shades of flawless coverage, their Woke Up Like This foundation is a bestseller for a reason. It's tough buying foundation online, but their Power Match quiz matched me perfectly. And with Try Before You Buy, you can try your shade free for 14 days. Take the quiz at ilmakiage.com/quiz. That's ilmakiage.com/quiz.